From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We all know what a magazine looks like on the coffee table or nightstand, but have you ever seen one performed on stage? Well, tonight, a group of artists and journalists perform Pop-Up Magazine at Atlanta's Variety Playhouse. A decade after its founding, Pop-Up Magazine performances routinely sell out in about a half an hour. So if you're not in Atlanta, or you didn't get tickets, or just have no idea what all this means, we've invited Aaron Edwards. He's senior story producer and co-host of Pop-Up Magazine to tell us more. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Josie Duffy Rice is also with us. She's a senior reporter for The Appeal, a contributor for Pop-Up Magazine, and an Atlanta native. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, Aaron, first, what the heck is Pop-Up Magazine?
That is one of the number one questions that we get, and a big reason is that we don't record it or put it online. But you did a pretty good job of describing it ahead of time.
Yeah, did I?
Yeah, so the best way to think about Pop-Up Magazine is think of your favorite magazine, you know, the thing you spend time with on your weekend, reading long-form stories or interviews. Take that, put it on stage, add a live orchestra, add live illustration, add surprise moments, and you have Pop-Up Magazine.
Live illustration? How did they do that?
So there's basically every theater that we go to, we bring in a massive screen that happens, that goes on stage, and while a contributor is reading a story, there is beautiful art that accompanies their story as well. So a lot of moving pieces, but it kind of feels like a play, a live podcast, a concert, and all those things wrapped into one.
How far do you carry the metaphor? Are there ads?
There are ads, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, so between every story, not every story, but every maybe three or four stories, there's an advertisement from one of our sponsors. So, and it's read on stage, just like you might, you know, experience it in a magazine while you're flipping through.
So does one act stop midway and continue on page 98? That kind of thing happen?
Yeah.
Well, Josie, you're one of the contributors for this issue, and that's what they call them, issues. You're playing the role of a food critic?
I am. I am trying foods live that I have never tried before.
Like? Or can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that I'm a very picky eater, which is kind of the subject of my story. And I've always been a very picky eater. And I tried a hamburger for the first time. Cheese.
Wait, how did you get through life without eating a hamburger?
Well, you'll have to see tonight. I'll tell you all about it. But yes, I tried a hamburger for the first time earlier in January, and I taped it for all of the Pop-Up Magazine audiences. So that is where my story is starts.
How did you get involved with this whole thing?
I actually saw Pop-Up Magazine last year here in Atlanta and just thought it was incredible. I thought it was just so well executed and beautiful. And they reached out to me earlier in the fall asking for story ideas, and I've been working with them for the past couple months. So it's a long process. It's a really, really enjoyable process. I've learned a ton, and I'm really glad to be part of it.
So you guys have been to a couple different cities so far, right, Aaron?
We have, yeah. So we're kind of in the two-thirds mark, or just finished the two-thirds mark. So Atlanta, and then we're going to Austin, and that'll be the end of our winter issue.
Where have you been so far?
Yeah, so we've been to L.A., we've been to Oakland, New York, D.C., and now we're here and happy to be in Atlanta.
Well, so when I read an article in Wired magazine, someone in Oakland or New York or D.C., they're reading the same thing. Do the shows vary from city to city?
They do, yeah. So depending on where we are, we really like to bring in people from the communities that we come into. So this is actually, I believe, the second time we've been in Atlanta. And so we try to make sure that we reach out to folks who live in every city that we go to. So the show feels a little bit bespoke to the place that we're at. So it's not just like we're parachuting in and bringing these national magazine stories to places. We really want to have a local feel to it, every place that we're at. So Josie, we're excited that she's here in Atlanta,
too. She's representing
for
Atlanta.
She's representing Atlanta, yeah.
Who else will be there tonight?
Yeah, so tonight we're going to have Rowan Jacobson is going to have a really interesting story that will involve some scent, actually. So who go might smell something that they haven't smelled before.
That's like the scratch and that's like the perfume ad you get in the middle of the magazine.
Exactly.
It's not the perfume ad necessarily, but it should be pretty exciting. So we have Josie, we have Rowan. We also are going to have, I believe, there's an amazing story from a contributor named Sophia Nali Allison, who's doing a film piece, actually, about something that was really tragic that happened between the Black and Asian community. I don't want to give it away entirely, but she's a wonderful filmmaker. And yeah, so it'll be a nice mix of stories of film and photography and writing, radio pieces, everything, the full
and
gamut.
And music?
And music, yeah. So the Magic Magic Orchestra is our live house band, and they travel around the country with us.
Okay, so, you know, you put out a couple of issues a year. This is the winter 2019 issue. But I'm thinking, you know, there's so many great magazines like Gourmet, Spy Magazine, right. Life Magazine. None of them, they kind of went the way of the buggy whip, as they say, no longer in print. There is a lot of news media experimentation with new ways of drawing audience. Is that what you're doing here?
Yeah. So, I mean, Pop-Up Magazine started off as just an experiment. It was really just kind of a hobby between a group of friends in the Bay Area. And their idea really was just to bring together all the people that they've worked with and that they've seen do incredible work and try to translate it into something that was a little bit more tangible and in person and live than what you experience when you sit and read a magazine. So that experiment took off, obviously, and people really respond well to it. So I do think that, you know, we do still live in the tradition of what magazine journalism feels like. The stories that we put on stage still have a really deep dedication to great reporting and incredible writing, to humor. Like Josie's piece cracks me up every single time I see it. So even though we're a little bit different than what a print magazine feels like, I think we still owe it to that tradition. We still kind of live and are a result of those things, too. So.
Which is kind of a solitary tradition. You know, you're sitting on a plane or you're sitting wherever, the smallest room in the house where you read a magazine, that kind of thing. Josie, what does that feel like for you to perform with these people and be bringing a magazine to life?
Well, what you said about it being generally a solitary tradition, I think is spot on, because what's so wonderful about Pop-Up Magazine is you're experiencing this with everybody there. And so you're kind of having the crowd reaction and something that is usually just between you and the page. Mm-hmm. And it's really such a great thing to kind of experience as a writer. And for me, because what I write about is normally criminal justice stuff, and it's much sadder, heavier, and the stakes are much higher. So it's really great to kind of be part of a project where I can tell something more lighthearted, more funny, more individual, and experience the crowd following along with me for the first time.
That's Josie Duffy Rice. She's a senior reporter for The Appeal and a contributor to Pop-Up Magazine, which is going to be performed tonight at the Variety Playhouse. Also with us, Aaron Edwards. He's a co-host of Pop-Up Magazine. Well, there's something else that's interesting about this. While a normal magazine can be tucked into a bag or whatever, Pop-Up Magazine is not recorded or taped. Aaron, why not?
Yeah, so we don't record the show, we don't tape it, we don't put it online. And I think a big reason for that is that we really want people to feel in the moment when they're at the show. You know, when you go to some live shows, there's still the expectation that it might end up on YouTube later, or that you could revisit it sometimes. And some artists, you know, put their recordings of their performances, you know, on HBO or whatever streaming platform that is available to them. And for us, we really want people to kind of, you know, take a pause for a second. And you know, I think that, you know, our executive editor, Anita Bottigio, had an incredible line that I really love, which is disconnect but not disengage. There's a really great experience, I think, when you sit down in the theater, the lights go down, and everyone just knows they're in for something special. And that feeling you can't really duplicate when you record it, when you put it online. So when we do make the show, we have this line when we introduce Pop-Up Magazine where we say, "We made tonight just for you." And that is really a big part of the ethos of what the magazine feels like, is that we put our time and effort to make this show. We want you to sit down and enjoy it with us. We want to enjoy these stories. And afterward, we have drinks in the lobby and everything like that. You get to meet people who are in the show. And there's just immediate feedback that happens between the audience and the performers. And we don't want to take away from that. So we try to make it as truly live an experience as possible.
Do you ask people not to tape it or stream it or, you know, take videos?
Yeah, I mean, people do at the end of the show. People are really excited. And so they like flip on their phone and just want to get a picture of we have a big title screen that says the end at the end of the show. So a lot of times after a show goes to a city, we see a bunch of photos on Twitter that just have like the end of the thing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing. So it's like people who didn't get to make it are just like, oh, man, I want to know what happened between the beginning and the end. So that's a big part of it, too.
But it also gives it a sense of sort of exclusivity. Like if you didn't get tickets, you're not there.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think what we do find is, especially, you know, at Atlanta, too, we sold out really quickly. And that's because it was a real word of mouth situation. You know, people mm-hmm. who came to the show the first time told their friends, people in other cities tell their colleagues. We have folks who, you know, really love the show and end up buying tickets for their entire offices, you know, so people really, really get into it. And that's exciting.
Well, I will tell you that a bunch of us from the Atlanta Radio Group have
nice.
Bought tickets
Great.
And are all planning to come.
Awesome.
Josie, I just want to get to more of that idea of how different this is for you. You've written articles for a number of publications, New York Times, Slate, Ebony. So how does writing an article, you know, sitting around that editorial table, planning for an article and putting together a magazine differ from this? Is it a collaborative effort among all of the people who are there?
In a lot of ways, it was pretty much the same until I walked out on stage for the first time. I mean, you're editing on paper, you're working with an editor from Pop-Up Magazine, you're trying to figure out how to best translate ideas to a bigger audience. You know, the order of things matters, the process of things matters. In another way, when you're writing for people to listen versus writing for people to read, it is very different. The words you use are different. The way you want to translate them is different. And you have the benefit, I think, of Pop-Up Magazine is that you have all these different things working with you. You have the music, you have kind of the intonation and the voice and the way that it plays out verbally. You have the words, you have the video. And so you really are getting a much more immersive experience when you're hearing about a story than you would even just reading it, I think. So, you know, in a lot of ways it's been similar, and then in many very important ways it's been quite different, including, again, the subject matter.
And you're performing in your home tonight,
I
right?
am.
Your
I'm hometown. Performing it in my home.
So
yeah.
Is the whole family
the
coming
whole
out?
The whole family is coming out. Yep. So I'm excited for them to see it. They're I think a little interested and a little wary so far. So I think they'll like it in the end.
But before this, you went to several other cities. Is there a moment or a performance that stood out for you in particular?
You know, they've all been really great so far, great audiences. I think it started in the Bay Area. So the Bay Area audience is particularly enthusiastic, I think. And, you know, one of the things that the executive editor, Anita, said before he walked out was the audience is rooting for you. Mm-hmm. And that has really been true. You know, it's such a welcoming space of people who want to hear your story, who are there to enjoy it, who, you know, engage completely and fully. And I can't say enough good things about the people who have come to the show so far. It's just been incredible.
Well, we have to wrap, Aaron, but wondering about your role as host. Will there be several costume changes?
There might be a few. Yeah, I brought like 3 different outfits. But yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, break a leg or whatever you say in the Pop-Up Magazine world tonight.
Thank you so much.
Atlanta native Josie Duffy Rice, and also Aaron Edwards, senior story producer and co-host of Pop-Up Magazine. That's a live event happening tonight at the Variety Playhouse. Again, Josie is an Atlanta local and a senior reporter for The Appeal and a contributor for Pop-Up Magazine. Now, Will Butler has been on the tour from the band Arcade Fire, so we are going to leave you with one of those songs called Suburbs while we take a quick break. But later in the show, we're going to talk with Silas House, who writes about a changing Appalachia in his book, Southernmost. It's one of those kind of things you actually pop down and read. It's not performed for you. Just ahead, Breast Cancer and Black and White. That's when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Breast cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths among Georgia women. The good news is that more than half of breast cancer deaths were prevented in the U.S. over the past 3 decades. And the big news? A big racial disparity in Georgia. African-American women are more likely to die from breast cancer than non-Hispanic white women. The American Cancer Society just released those findings, and Carol DeSantis is director of breast and gynecological surveillance and lead author of the study. Hello, Carol. Hi. Well, thanks. Welcome. Thank you for being here. Janice McKenzie Creighton is from the Komen Atlanta's Sisters of Promise, and she's joining us. She's a three-time breast cancer survivor. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. Carol, I'd love you to break down some of these numbers and the most recent breast cancer statistics related to Georgia. How many people are affected and how many people survive?
So this year, we estimate that about 8,000 new cases of breast cancer will be diagnosed in Georgia women, and about 1,350 breast cancer deaths will occur among Georgia women.
So how are the numbers stacking up compared to in the past?
So these are similar to numbers in the past. Breast cancer death rates have been declining since about 1990. That's when they were at their highest. But what we see is that breast cancer death rates are declining much faster in white women compared to African-American women.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that initially led us to this story and topic was a listener who said, you know, I've seen it mapped by zip code in Atlanta, how many black and white women have cancer. We did not find any peer-reviewed reporting on that. So tell us more about this racial gap among survivors in Georgia. What are the numbers?
So breast cancer death rates are about 45% higher in black women compared to white women in Georgia. So their risk of being diagnosed with breast cancer is very similar, but their risk of dying of breast cancer is, as I said, about 45% higher.
Any indications as to why this is the case?
So in the U.S., race is very closely linked with socioeconomic status, and it really is the socioeconomic disparities that we were seeing here. So it's access to the best quality treatment, early detection. That is what's really driving this racial disparity.
Mm-hmm. So the difference in the diagnoses themselves are not changing, it's the outcomes.
Yeah, those aren't changing at all. Now, there is breast cancer in black women. There is a subtype triple negative breast cancer that's more common in black women, and that there's not as many treatments for this. Hormone therapy is not effective in those types of breast cancer, so that is a difference, but that's not changing, and that's not what's really driving this.
Janice, you're a three-time breast cancer survivor. When or how were you first diagnosed?
Well, in 1996, right after the Olympics, I went for my annual checkup. Mm. And my doctor, who I call my Shiro to this day, said, Janice, something's very different here. This doesn't look like it did last year. And so you began kind of this interesting path of meeting with and working with folk you don't know, but ultimately I was diagnosed. And about 8 years later, again, and then about 10 years later, again.
And how long has it been since you've been?
2013 was my last diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. So after 5 years, doesn't the diagnosis, or the, let's say, the prognosis change quite
yes,
a bit?
Yes, it does. And so interesting that we talk about the socioeconomic component to this. And I was just very blessed to have the best of care and a wonderful support system that I think has made a difference for me and for my family. And I think that's why we got started with a group at Susan Komen called Sisters of Promise.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that group.
Maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, we started working on bringing a group of concerned and capable African-American women together to talk about how do you close the disparity gap? What kinds of things on the ground could we do to be helpful and to have a real stake in changing the dynamic? And so there's a group of us that are about 12, start out about 12, and we in August will be at about 3 years, but really more like two in terms of really getting out there and getting the work done. So wonderful young women who believe in it and put their elbow grease behind it and their influence. All of them are very capable, influential women in this city who really want to make a difference.
So as you are going through treatment, what kind of advice did you get, or did your healthcare team talk to you about the kinds of treatments that you could get, and because you're a woman, maybe possible effects on fertility.
Right. Well, I'm retired now, so even back then, you know, we didn't want to talk too much about fertility in my house. We were about through with all of that, honestly. But what we, you know, I think the side effects were really the things that I dealt with, you know, more directly. I think I've had the best of care. This most recent diagnosis involved a double mastectomy and treatment at MD Anderson. So I've been very fortunate to be able to go to the best places for my health and for my care. And I think it's made a difference. I don't suffer from the socioeconomic component that so cripples so many African-American women. I think that's why I do it every day. I know what difference it's made for me. And I'd just like at some point for everyone to have the same opportunity, the same support system, the same options. And ultimately, I think it means that we'll see a real decrease. At Komen, we have a goal to decrease breast cancer deaths by 50% by 2026. And we know that the greatest effort needs to be around African-American women and women of color.
Well, you are a powerful witness for that, and I'm glad you're here for that. But Carol, how about that? You know, a goal of decrease by 50%. You're looking at the numbers. You're looking at the statistics. What does it take to get there?
Well, I think in this country, access to healthcare insurance is that the first thing that you have to have. So expanding access to insurance to all women, the Affordable Care Act really helped that. And our research team has documented that women with insurance are more likely to be diagnosed with earlier stage cancer, and that survival is better among people with insurance. So expanding healthcare insurance to more people. Georgia hasn't expanded Medicaid. It's one of a few states that haven't. So that could really make a difference for women here in Georgia if more of them were covered by insurance.
That's Carol DeSantis. She's from the American Cancer Society. Also with us, Janice McKenzie Creighton, a three-time breast cancer survivor, and she's chair of Komen's Atlanta's Sisters of Promise. So I'm seeing numbers, and this is something that the American Cancer Society Association reported, the racial gap in cancer mortality is slowly narrowing. What is the reason for that?
Well, so overall for cancer, for breast cancer, it's not narrowing yet, but overall we do see a narrowing, and that's really faster declines in smoking-related cancers. That's contributing to that.
Okay, so not necessarily just breast cancer. And the American Cancer Society no longer recommends that women do monthly self-exams. Why not?
So our recommendations for screening are based on research of what actually reduces the risk of death from breast cancer. And the research didn't support monthly self-breast exams. But we do recommend for sure that women are very aware of their breasts and any kind of change that is not typical be reported to their physician. So breast awareness is important, that standard routine monthly health exam. That's not what is recommended anymore.
Well, Atlanta is home to several healthcare and medical facilities, the CDC, for example, the American Cancer Society. Why do you think our state in particular sees such large number in breast cancer diagnoses?
Well, Georgia is not a higher breast cancer state than other states. It's not a higher risk here. But yes, there are a lot of public health organizations here, and I think that, you know, we can do more and partner with these organizations to try to close this racial gap in Georgia.
Well, Janice, it's so interesting that you and the speakers at the International Women's Forum is coming up this Thursday. After hearing your diagnosis and beating this disease, you talked about, you know, you want to keep going with this because there is disparity. You want to other African-American women to know about this. But what does that speaking do? Are you speaking to an audience of people who already know, or how do you reach new ones?
Well, you know what? You make an assumption that people know.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the first thing that I'd say. The second is that there is just a real need for those that don't know to have greater education, greater exposure to their options, right? And also to those who do know to inspire them and energize them, right, to take, for lack of a better word, take it to the streets.
Mm.
So at Komen, we do mobile mammography in neighborhoods where folk don't know. And it absolutely makes a difference getting them in, getting early diagnosis. So it is a socioeconomic thing, but it is also that the later you're diagnosed, that the higher your risk is that things are not going to go well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing things early on, I went every year for my annual checkup. I found, interesting enough, I found my second one.
You did.
Through breast examination.
Mm-hmm.
I said, So in the same way that my doctor said early on, you know, the first time, something's not right here. There I sat in the bed and I said, something is not right here. And immediately went to the doctor with great insurance,
mm-hmm.
right? And got on the early end of what was going on. So education for us, you know, we're laymen, so we're not going to pretend that we understand all the research and the like, but we know that if you know more, you'll do better.
Mm.
And so that has been our approach, and it seems that it is making a difference. We go to churches, right? We partner with sororities. African-American women are highly engaged with their sororities, even after college. And so we are making the case wherever we can. Middle-class women sometimes don't know. Those that do know can be more advocates. And I think that's what we're trying to build through Sisters of Promise.
Carol, the breast cancer campaign, pink ribbons all over the place, have really raised awareness of the disease. And we've seen breakthroughs in technology and a decline in breast cancer deaths, as reported. So what are still the concerns for your organization or the priorities?
So there are some things that we know that can reduce your risk of breast cancer. So getting that message out, letting women know some of the things that they can do, like maintaining a healthy body weight, being physically active. Alcohol increases your risk of breast cancer, as does the use of menopausal hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And breastfeeding lowers your risk of breast cancer. And then just, it's so important for women, as you said, Janice, to get mammography screening. Recommendations are that beginning at age 40, women can consider annual mammography. By 45, they should begin annual mammography. And then after age 55, the American Cancer Society says that women can transition to every 2 years or continue with annual mammography based on their risk and their discussions with their doctors.
Is there any indication of racial disparity for after treatment? You know, that after somebody is treated for cancer, that their care continues? Any of those indications? You talked about the difference in socioeconomics in terms of treatment.
So we look at survival by stage at diagnosis. So Black women have lower 5-year survival for breast cancer at each stage. So for those diagnosed early, the survival is lower. For those diagnosed late, survival is lower. So that's really points to that the treatment, they're not getting the same treatment.
Mm-hmm. So, Janice, I'm wondering for those listening, have breast cancer or maybe afraid to get mammograms, what would your advice be to them?
Just go do it. I mean, it really is something you need. Often we say that, you know, we kind of stereotype women, and we say, you know, we take care of everybody but ourselves. But even if you thought about it in terms of, I want to take care of my family, the only way you can do that is by first taking care of yourself. Mm. And so, just do it. I think at some point women need to design a new mammography machine. Clearly has to be that a man came up with that idea.
I'm
going to
sign up for that one as well
But beyond that, it is just so important to receive the information and then do something with it. And I think that's another piece of what we try to do at Susan Komen, Sisters of Promise. Encourage folk. We say, see, this is where we've been. Look at our outcome. At least get out there and give yourself a fighting chance.
Janice McKenzie Creighton, she's a 3-time breast cancer survivor and chair of Komen Atlanta's Sisters of Promise. Clearly someone you'd want to listen to. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Carol DeSantis, she's from the American Cancer Society, also speaking about breast cancer disparities and one of those who designs and reports on breast cancer statistics. Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The novel Southernmost begins with a flood of biblical proportions. What emerges after is not a sliver of mountaintop, but a sodden southern Appalachian town where a fundamentalist preacher struggles mightily with his rigid beliefs. Silas House has written several books about a part of rural America, often portrayed with stale stereotypes. He's also a reporter, columnist, and host of On the Porch with Silas House. It's a podcast. And he's among the authors who will be at the Savannah Book Festival this weekend. He's joining us from Skype from his home in eastern Kentucky. Silas House, welcome.
Hi, Virginia. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. Let's talk about that book opening, Winds, Tennessee. It's a town where Asher Sharp is his name, and his family are suspended. They're just waiting for a flood. Who is Asher Sharp?
Well, he's a father in his mid-30s. He's a fundamentalist preacher, and his whole life he has been trying his best to do the right thing. And then the flood makes him realize that he's been doing other people's version of the right thing and not what he really believes in. So it's a game changer for him.
Mm, the flood is epic, and he goes and looks out over the Cumberland River swelling with rain early in the book, and you write, and he could hear the flood. So eerie. The book is kind of a thriller in a way, or let's say a getaway book. Did you set out to write that?
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I really did want to write a literary thriller. I wanted it to be very language-driven, but also fast-paced. I love the process of creating strong characters that readers can get endeared to, and I really want my work to be very lyrical and to have a strong sense of place and really put you there. But I also want it to move, and that's especially important for this novel because it's about a man on the run. Mm. You know, he's on the run from the law. So,
and you've been singled out for your nuanced portraits of complex characters in life in rural Appalachia. Why, Silas, do you think that the media at large so often get this part of the country wrong?
Well, I think that, for at least 100 years, in the movies and on TV in particular, it's just been that, go-to joke, and it's still politically correct in a world where hardly anything is really to make fun of Southerners and rural people. And I think the reason for that is because people always connect the rural and the southern with poverty. And so, even if people don't realize it, ultimately they're just feel it's okay to make fun of poor people because mm-hmm. poor people don't have power, For me, that's what it usually comes down to. I think there's so much shame involved in it and shaming people for being from a particular place in the world.
Well, this is the first time, however, of all the novels you've written really directly about gay characters. Why now?
I think when I was working on this book, I worked on it about 8 years. The issue of marriage equality was such a huge part of the national conversation. And I was just thinking so much about the way I have seen so many people in my life, the way they have evolved on that and changed on it so tremendously in my lifetime. And when marriage equality happened in 2015, I never thought I would see that in my lifetime. And I never thought that I would see the evolution in so many people that I know on this issue. And so I wanted to write a book that really examined all that complexity. And I wanted to look at it from the point of view of everybody, from somebody who was very homophobic to the point of holding a gun on her child because he was gay, all the way to somebody who's totally accepting, and a preacher like Asher who decides that he can no longer be silent, and he stands up in front of his congregation and tells them they need to be more accepting. And what I really wanted to do was portray all of those people without making anyone into a caricature. Hmm. And for that reason, I think the book is even more relevant now than when I was writing it, because I think it gets easier and easier for us to just put each other into these little boxes and to take our complexity away as human beings and, you know, just say somebody is this political party or that political party, or they're this kind of Christian, or they don't believe in anything or whatever, instead of looking at each other as individuals and really talking to each other.
Well, you yourself grew up in a fundamentalist tradition, is that correct?
I did, right. Yes. I grew up in a holiness church. And, you know, there's so many things that I disliked about the church by the time I was a teenager. And, I just could not get on board with a lot of the dogma that was being preached. I felt a lot of sexism and racism and xenophobia and homophobia in my particular church. But as I've gotten older, I can also recognize some of the good things about that church, you know, and how loved I felt by the people in that church, the community that I had, the way I was living within that culture. But also, you know, as an adult, I can look back and see the good and the bad. I think that's what a novel should do. I think a novel should complexify the issues and complexify a place. That's what I've always struggled to do with the South, is just not show it as I don't want to romanticize it or vilify it. I just want to show it as a complicated place.
Well, part of the complication begins for Asher after the flood, and there's this couple, gay couple. There, and by the way, the rain begins the day, I think, after the SCOTUS decision, which many of the fundamentalists interpret as, you know, God's wrath. But there's this couple, Jimmy and Steven. They're country music songwriters in Nashville, but they're not, you know, effete. They're not outsiders. They didn't come there for cheap real estate. They're actually churchgoers. They want to be a part of the church there. Why did you make those choices in particular for these characters?
Well, I wanted to have characters, gay characters, who wanted to live in a rural place, because so many people think that all gay people just leave rural places. They think that, you know, we escape. And also, I think that often people don't often put LGBT people in church. Mm-hmm. They, you know, a lot of people's idea of gay people is very different from that. And, you know, my experience as a gay person what's just as important to me and my gay identity is my belief identity. And so I wanted to write about characters like me, you know, characters who are gay but also go to church every Sunday and also live in a rural place. And I just don't think we see those characters represented in media enough. So that was why it was important to me to do that in the novel.
Well, it all gets set off when Asher offers the shelter to this gay couple whose house washed away in the flood. His wife, however, is worried that what the congregation would say and, you know, doesn't want her young son to be around these people. Do you still see that in small towns dominated by the church? You know, the people have never met a gay person.
Oh, absolutely.
Really, I think, still?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in my own life in a small town, you know, I see so many really homophobic, discriminating people. And I also see so many totally accepting, loving people. So I think Appalachia and the South is really a microcosm for the rest of America, because I think that happens everywhere. And I mean, I've experienced homophobia in, you know, this rural little small town I was raised in, but I've also experienced it in New York City and Greenwich Village. So I think that when we write about the South, it's just illuminating those things that happen everywhere else.
My guest, Silas House, made his name writing nuanced best-selling books about life in Southern Appalachia. His most recent is called Southernmost, and it's about one man's struggle against his own and his town's homophobia. Well, you mentioned he takes a stand. You know, he stands up in front of his church and somehow moves from the certainty of judgment backed by his community to questioning all this teaching and tradition and belonging that that affords. I'm wondering what that was like for you, writing about this process of thrashing around, you know, between his felt sense that he grew up with and his love for a brother who was gay and who left a decade earlier, pretty much at gunpoint.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it is a real challenge to write about belief and doubt. I mean, those are such abstract notions, but also, to me, that's what really fuels a novel, you know, is if I can put my characters in as much trouble as possible, then I have everything I need, you know, to make that novel work. And Asher is in so much trouble, you know, because he's questioning his own beliefs. He's questioning everything he's been taught. He knows that he's going to have to sacrifice his job and that he might lose custody of his little boy, et cetera, if he stands up for what he believes in. But he knows that he has to do that. Ultimately, to me, the novel is the most important part of it is this love between the father and his child. And he just he decides that the best thing he can do for his child is to set a good example for him. And so that's, you know, that's where he follows his heart.
And his son, Justin, 8 years old, he's kind of an outsider in his own way. He's a really sensitive kid. His wife, Lydia, says it's not normal for a kid to be so tender-hearted, so regarded with some suspicion by other people around him, and certainly bullied at school. Where did this character come from for you?
Well, for one thing, I wanted the novel to not, you know, just be about gay issues. I wanted it to be about the way that we're othered in so many ways. And so Justin is a good example of that, where he's just, you know, he's considered different and weird simply because he's so sensitive and he feels things in such a deep, profound way. So he's not, you know, considered normal by what a little boy should be. And throughout the book, Asher is always encountering people who are treated as the other for one reason or another. But also I have two children, and one of them in particular was always very sensitive, you know, to the point of sort of being upset about walking across the grass in case an ant was harmed, you know. And so I just thought that was a really good way, a good character to use in a novel that's all about empathy, really. It's about how, you know, if we strive to be more compassionate, we will end up being happier people. That by being good to people, it actually is better for us and makes us happier.
Well, there's a way that, you know, novels often can cast their gaze on a little town like this. But in this book, the real world is coming in when Asher implores his congregation to welcome the gay couple. That, of course, a video is taken of it, and it's viewed millions of times on YouTube. And gay rights organizations want him to become a kind of spokesperson, and reporters and Fox News stake him out. So there's this real-time technology that these little issues are no longer contained in small towns. Is that
the bringer of change? Is that the real revolution?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think we're all global people now. You know, we're all so connected. There's no isolation. This is my first novel that's set during the digital age, and I really struggled to write that, you know, in that it's hard to be lyrical when you're talking about things like iPhones and email and, you know, and our phones are just so present. But I felt that I had to incorporate that to make it contemporary. And so, of course, you know, if this preacher is given this passionate plea for acceptance, some teenager in the audience is going to film that and put it on the internet. And so it actually works really well for the novel because it does make him into this folk hero. And that's very surprising to him. So I really love that aspect of it.
Just want to close out here. We've got a minute left. You know, I felt a lot of empathy for Asher's struggle, and I felt myself cheering on his transformation. But I was also wondering, like, okay, you know, another woke white man somehow a triumph. I mean, how did you feel writing about that?
Oh, that's a good point. Well, I think, you know, that's who I am, and that's the perspective I was writing from. And I think it's important for me to show a white man who is, you know, really pushing himself and trying to be conscious. And he, in this case, I think Cash is a really good example. He understands his own privilege, you know, and he knows that he has this straight privilege and this white privilege. And so to me, that's the best lesson in any of these cases, is we have to be aware of that, and we have to be willing to listen. And Asher's really willing to listen and to learn. And that's what I really love about him.
Yeah, this is all going on in an interior struggle. But then accepting of another's difference is one thing in the abstract. He can love his brother, but no idea what that actually looks like for him.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you leave that?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but I do think it's really important that he doesn't get totally absolved. You know, his brother refuses to just let him off the hook completely. And I think that's important, is, you know, when people have... I do believe that forgiveness is really important. But I don't think that we have to forget transgressions like these. I think that we can forgive, but we also have to remember when people have done wrong so hugely.
Well, forgiveness is a big part of this book. Silas House, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Silas House's newest book is called Southernmost, and he will be among the authors at the Savannah Book Festival this weekend, along with us at On Second Thought. That's all we have time for today. We'll see you tomorrow.